Ladies and gentlemen, because the chairman of the mathematics department is out of town, and because the chairman of the English department somehow outfumbled me, I have the great pleasure of introducing our speaker this afternoon. Mr. Friedman, who is going to speak for the team consisting of Mr. Friedman and Mrs. Friedman, started his career as a cipher studier at the Riverbank Laboratories near Chicago, Illinois, before World War I. His purpose in taking up the study of Shakespearean ciphers was to entice Mrs. Friedman to marry him, as I understand it, because he had a job as a geneticist at the time, and having studied Mrs. Friedman, and he felt that it was genetically desirable that he meet her, and she had a job studying Shakespeare. He's been in some sort of cryptological work ever since, mainly for the United States Army, and after the Army merged with the Navy to form the Army, Navy, Marine Corps, Air Force, Department of Defense, and the Strategic Air Command, well, he has worked for the Department of Defense. This is undoubtedly his most important work, and I can't describe it to you because of the high secrecy, and besides that, I don't know what it is, but I have some evidence of its importance. He has received one of the 300 Medals of Merit, Medals for Merit, which have been awarded in our nation's history. He has received one of the 6 National Security Medals, which have been awarded. He has received the War Department Medal for Distinguished Civil Service. Mr. and Mrs. Friedman, between them, received the Fulgur Shakespeare Library Prize for Literature in 1955 for what was essentially the text of their book, The Shakespearean Ciphers Examined, which was published in 1957 by the Cambridge University Press. They also received the 5th Annual Shakespeare Award by the American Shakespeare Festival Theater and Academy. And here I quote from the announcement of this, for bringing with wit, learning, and patience their technical knowledge of cryptology to the academic problem of authorship. Their book was listed as one of the 22 most important general books of 1957 in the recapitulation at the end of the year by the Saturday Review of Literature. And it was one of the 2 recommended for rereading by Jacques Barzan in the American Scholar the same year. Mrs. Friedman has an honorary Doctor of Law degrees, which was awarded to her for contributions to the American and Canadian governments in the intelligence field. She has worked for several years for the Treasury Department in their intelligence division. They have 2 grown adult children, one of whom is married to a beautiful blonde. And I guess this is about all I know about them, except to say that I have known Mr. Friedman very well for several years now, since World War II. He certainly made very considerable contributions to our government during 3 wars, World War I, World War II, and the Korean War. Mr. and Mrs. Friedman, between them, give the lie to the rumor that's going around through the country that every civil servant is just a dull person who knows nothing, who is not interested in scholarship, and who simply goes to work as late as possible in the morning and comes home as early as possible at evening. It is indeed a real pleasure to introduce Mr. Friedman as one of this team of 2 very wonderful scholars who have worked for many years for our government. Mr. Friedman.
Professor Tompkins, Professor Phillips, ladies and gentlemen, Professor Tompkins disappointed me twice. First, he offered to talk until 3:45, leaving me 2 minutes until the char force comes. And secondly, he made a statement which I cannot let go by without challenging, even the expense of chivalry. He indicated that I changed from genetics to cryptology in my struggles to induce the beautiful young lady to marry me. Now, there is the discrepancy between that story and the title of a talk which I gave in New York City before my class, Cornell 1914, last month, in which I addressed my classmates under the title, From Biology to Cryptology, A Story of a Seduction in Two Acts. Well, when the professional cryptologist studies the usage of cryptography in the literary world, he is astonished by the numerous attempts of amateurs in his field to prove that the immortal plays attributed usually to William Shakespeare were written by somebody else. The question of the authorship of the plays has been argued for so many years and so vehemently that it came to be called at first the Bacon-Shakespeare controversy. But when the names of other possible authors were introduced into the picture, the question was broadened to the great controversy. Apparently, it is of worldwide interest, and indeed, it has reached a level of importance sufficient to merit treatment on those pages of the daily newspapers which are devoted to the so-called comics and cartoons. Here is an example. Scene? Super quick. Another one from the intellectual comic, Pogo. A summary of the origins of the controversy would be interesting, but all that need be said today is that it was apparently touched off in modern times by a book entitled The Romance of Yachting, published in 1848 by a New York attorney named Joseph C. Hart. The book has almost nothing to do with yachting and has been called by one critic a kind of hornbook of digression. Hart expressed skepticism of Shakespearean authorship but laid no claim for Bacon or for anybody else. Hart's doubts set persons to searching for earlier expressions of skepticism, and after a century's delving, several early doubting Thomases seem to have been resurrected, among whom was a certain Captain Goulding, who, in his, quote, Essay Against Too Much Reading, 1728, alleges that Shakespeare had, quote, chuckle-pated historians and other sorts of assistants to help him. In short, that he had collaborators. 41 years after Goulding, in 1769, there was published in England a curious little historical allegory entitled The Life and Adventures of Common Sense. Here's the title page of the book. I'll show you the bits which are of special interest to us. Since Francis Bacon kept a commonplace book which has survived for posterity, supporters of Baconian authorship of the plays construe wisdom to be none other than Bacon. I think that these slides got turned around a bit, but wisdom was the principal character whose book was stolen by this chap who turned out to be Shakespeare. But it seems Baconians construe wisdom to be none other than Bacon. But it seems that a certain Reverend James Wilmot was the very first person to suggest specifically the name of Francis Bacon. And he did so in 1785. That is, 221 years after Shakespeare was born, and 160 years after the first folio was printed. Now, I'll show you two slides of a book which many Baconians use as evidence of Shakespearean, of Baconian authorship also. The Story of the Learned Pig. Anonymous. With equal falsehood, has he been fathered with many spurious dramatic pieces, Hamlet, Othello, As You Like It, The Tempest, The Midsummer Night's Dream, for five, of all of which I confess myself to be the author. Well, Pig is Bacon, of course. Let's have the lights, please. Since then, of course, Bacon's name has been and continues to be mentioned most often as the real author of the plays. I think there is probably at least one earlier doubting Thomas than I have shown here, but I don't want to take too much time on that. Recent work has brought the name of Edward de Vere, the 17th Earl of Oxford, much more prominently to the fore than has been the case for some time. In fact, a scholarly tome of 1,300 pages of small print advocating Oxfordian authorship was published in 1952 by a New York attorney, Charlton Ogburn, and his wife, who collaborated. The Oxfordian authorship thesis was launched in 1920 by an English schoolteacher named J. Thomas Looney, but let's not make anything of his name in this connection. Others, many others, in fact, have been nominated for the crown. By 1950, to sum up this historical background, more than 4,000 books and articles in at least six languages support or dispute the claims presented for 17 possible authors. Our book was published last year, and one to be published in September by the University of California Press under the authorship of Professor Frank W. Wadsworth, who is here with us this afternoon, the Department of English at UCLA, have added to the chorus of the devotees of the great controversy. Besides Francis Bacon, the Elizabethan or Jacobean writers whose names have been proposed in all seriousness are Roger Manners, the 5th Earl of Rutland, William Stanley, the 6th Earl of Derby, Edward de Vere, the 17th Earl of Oxford, Sir Anthony Shirley, Sir Walter Raleigh, Robert Cecil, the Earl of Salisbury, Sir Edward Dyer, Daniel Defoe. Who wasn't born until a good many years after the first folio was printed. Let's see. Oh yes, his attention as off, his nomination was made in my office by a chap who sent in his card. My secretary brought the card. God forgive me, I hope he's nowhere around. It said George M. Batty. Ben Jonson, Chapman, Fletcher, Spencer, and currently a Long Island newspaperman, Calvin Hoffman, has been publicizing the name of his pet nominee, Christopher Marlowe. Even Anne Hathaway has been suggested as author. And believe it or not, Elizabeth Tudor was nominated in a book published only last year by one George Eliot Sweet and titled Shakespeare, The Mystery. This reminds me of a squib that appeared in Bennett Cerf's column in the January 1957 issue of the Saturday Review. Quote, at Sardi's, Harvey Bright told about a scholar who insisted that Shakespeare's plays had been written by Queen Elizabeth. The eminent Scots minister, Dr. Hugo Black, challenged him. Surely, he scoffed, you don't believe a woman could have composed such masterpieces. You miss my point entirely, said the scholar. It is my contention that Queen Elizabeth was a man. In addition to the nominees I've mentioned, there are some who, following the lead of Captain Goulding, contend that a group of writers collaborated as a team or syndicate. Or, as we might say today, they had a project. Maybe they called it Operation Shakespeare. Or, for security reasons, they gave it a code name and called it Project Operation 3Ws. Who wrote what? No doubt, some members of this audience may well wonder why the controversy arose. What's wrong with Shakespeare that so many people are unwilling to accept him as author of the plays? What kind of evidence has kept the controversy going? The thesis of anti-Shakespearean authorship is supported by three types of argument: historical, stylistic, and cryptographic. Historical matters seem to be every man's stamping ground. The term covers a wide range of considerations, too many to mention in this talk. Stylistic questions are best left to savants in literary criticism, and these surely are best left to specialists in the history of English literature. That leaves us with arguments based upon alleged cryptographic evidence. Whereas historical and stylistic arguments always bring counter-arguments or counter-interpretations in respect to whatever evidence is offered, there are no such avenues for pro and con disputations in regard to cryptographic evidence. If the question of cryptography is introduced into the great controversy, the evidence is either provable or it is not provable. It is valid or it is invalid. Nothing in between can exist. There can be no moot points. The question in this area of the great controversy boils down to this. Has a genuine cipher been found thus far in the many attempts to find one? This is quite different from the question, could a genuine cipher have been placed or hidden in the plays? The answer to the latter question is, as I hope to show you, of course it could. But before we can go any further into the question of cryptographic evidence, we ought to keep in mind certain simple but quite fundamental principles upon which the science of cryptology rests. And here too I will have to be brief. It is sufficient to remark to this audience that it should be perfectly obvious to everybody, but it isn't, that a good cipher, a cipher worthy of the name, must be composed strictly in accordance with certain inflexible rules, so that a would-be decipherer or your communicator at the other end can recover without question the exact text of the message that had been originally put into cipher. That's the first requirement of a real cipher system. Stated in another way, there must be some precise key or keys which must be followed rigorously in encipherment and which must be capable of being applied with precision in the reverse manner in decipherment. Secondly, the text which is recovered by deciphering the cipher must be intelligible. It must make sense to the people who write or speak the language that has been enciphered. And finally, if two or more investigators decipher the same message by a proper application of the rules underlying the cipher, the texts they recover must be identical. They must arrive at the same answer. In general, in a cryptographic problem, as in a mathematical problem, there is only one correct solution. Or, if we wish to make an absolutely accurate statement of the matter, there is one and only one correct solution set to a problem in mathematics. Note that I don't say anything here about the consistency of the deciphered texts with what people generally agree are facts, historical facts. The cryptanalyst is not concerned with the truth or falsity of what comes out as the decipherment. He will accept as valid whatever statement comes out, so long as it is structurally sound, grammatically and orthographically. We come first to Ignatius Donnelly, a pioneer Minnesotan lawyer, entrepreneur, and politician. Donnelly used all three types of evidence to support his convictions as to Shakespearean authorship, but it is clear that he relied principally on his cryptographic evidence because his two volumes, totaling 1,000 pages, published in 1888, bears the title The Great Cryptogram, in which his cryptographic demonstrations occupy 400 pages. Donnelly, in preparing his readers for his demonstrations, says enough to make it perfectly clear that he accepts the prime necessity for order and precision in cryptological work. And yet, in his book, when we examine it, we find no fixed principles, no order, no precision, no inflexible rules. There is, however, one principle unmentioned. Make your cryptography fit the message your subconscious imagines is present. Donnelly's system is very roughly described as an arithmetical one. He adds, subtracts, multiplies, and divides, fudging a bit now and then when his arithmetic doesn't bring him to the word he wants. It doesn't bother him, but it does bother us. And the sad part of the whole business is that the secret history he purports to unravel is puerile at best, sheer nonsense at worst, and for the rest, psychoanalytically quite revealing. There is a photograph of a page in Donnelly's work to show the abstruse calculations, the complexity of what he had done. And now for some of the text. Wonderful statement that Marlowe, that's Marlowe, or Shakespeare never read a word of them. But it is not merely by the amount of labor and ingenuity expended in producing a decipherment that its validity is to be judged. Let us apply our threefold rule and test his results, despite the abstruse nature of the page I showed you, as typical of his calculations. He followed some rules, but in so haphazard a manner and with so many exceptions to them that they can hardly be taken seriously. The second requirement Donnelly meets if we are charitable. The texts are intelligible. But as to the third, no two persons working independently can possibly get the same results. It was only to be expected that Donnelly's thesis and his decipherments would be challenged, and they were, quite promptly. If in any cryptographic system alleged to follow authentic procedures, the application of the alleged keys or key by two different investigators working with the same material yields results which are incompatible, that system carries with it its own reputation. Such a reputation was easy in Donnelly's case, and here's an example taken from a little pamphlet entitled, not inappropriately, The Little Cryptogram, by a man named Pyle and published in 1888, that is, in the same year that Donnelly's work was published. He goes through the same kind of calculations. He adds, he subtracts, so forth. He gets the word, page and column. Donnelly, the author, politician, and mountebank, will work out the secret of this play, The Sage is a Daisy. Other investigators have had no difficulty and perhaps some amusement in duplicating Pyle's simple feat of refutation. An English clergyman named Nicholson did so in 1888 in a brochure entitled No Cipher in Shakespeare. Nicholson demolished Donnelly's thesis in a kindly way. He showed, incidentally, that according to Donnelly's loose method, there were in the first folio 3,309,000 chances of finding any word Donnelly needed to compose his cipher story. Nicholson composed one himself. It runs quite counter to Donnelly. Master William Shakespeare writ the play and was engaged at the curtain. We turn our attention next to Orville W. Owen, a Detroit physician, who, beginning in 1893, began publishing what was to be a six-volume work. Owen claimed to have deciphered what he called Sir Francis Bacon's cipher story, not the least fantastic part of which is Owen's claim that he deciphered this secret autobiography by means of rules which he had first to decipher in the biography itself. This sort of circular argument is a very excellent trick if you are not caught doing it. Here are Dr. Owen's rules for his cipher. The rules begin somewhere in here. Match the syllogisms duly and orderly and put together systematically and minutely the chain and so forth. Now these rules don't look as inflexible as, well, let's say Los Angeles traffic rules. Dr. Owen was probably miscast as a physician. He should have been a real estate broker or an automobile salesman, for he not only found one, but two angels to finance good-sized excavation projects in England in a frantic search for Shakespearean or Baconian manuscripts. I'm sorry, there's no time to tell you about these big deals. They yielded nothing. Oh, except a few drinks for the doctor. As yet, I haven't told you what Owen's cryptographic system was like. In brief, what he did was merely to lift lines, passages, and even whole sections from the Shakespeare plays and reassemble them in some order which made, for him, a more or less plausible story. But he didn't confine his operations to the Shakespeare plays. His method allowed him to use anything that Bacon, Marlowe, Peel, Spencer, Green, Burton, and other Elizabethan and Jacobean writers published. As, for example, that's some of his stuff. He doesn't show you where it comes from. This I supplied. Indeed, Owen claimed that his cipher system proved that Bacon wrote everything that those writers I've mentioned ever wrote. Owen decided that his own labors and those of his assistants would be facilitated by a machine which he built, and a picture of which I now show you. It's two wheels or big drums upon which he mounted a canvas, a long canvas cloth, on which he mounted pages from the first folio and pages from Burton, Peel, Spencer, and so forth. And there's a crank, you see there, you turned it. And the typewriter, it's not automatic, unfortunately. And now Dr. Owen lived in Detroit. I wonder if by any chance Henry Ford got his ideas about assembly line mass production manufacturing methods from the good doctor. There's one more thing about Owen's story which I must mention. It is that he was the one who initiated the story that Francis Bacon was the son of Queen Elizabeth, a story which made a profound impression upon his principal assistant, Elizabeth Wells Gallup, who, working independently after leaving Dr. Owen's employ, wrote a large book entitled The Biliteral Cipher of Sir Francis Bacon. It was published in 1900, and I have a copy, not of the first edition, but of, I think, the third edition with me. The first edition is too precious to carry around. I have a copy, though, in our library. It was published in 1900. It was quite a sensation. So let's look into Mrs. Gallup's book. It was our good fortune, Mrs. Friedman and myself, to have known Mrs. Gallup. In fact, from 1915 to the end of 1920, save for my year in the Army, during the period 1918-19, we lived under the same roof. During that time, we had excellent opportunities not only for acquiring first-hand detailed knowledge of her work, but also for gaining an insight into her character. I want to say in regard to the latter point that I soon came to have a very high regard for her. Indeed, I think my respect for her as a woman was tinged with the devotion a young man has for his aged mother, for she was much advanced in years when we knew her. We doubt if more honest, sincere, gentle, upright, and devoutly religious Christian women than Mrs. Gallup and her devoted sister and assistant ever lived. This is Mrs. Gallup. We also came to have a high regard for her intelligence, her learning, her astuteness in tireless endeavors to have her work accepted as valid. As a matter of fact, of all the attempts at cryptographic proofs of Baconian authorship of the plays, the Gallup attempt is by far the best, the most plausible, the one that makes the greatest appeal to professional cryptographers, and therefore the one most worthy of serious attention. Let's look into it. Mrs. Gallup, if you'll recall, was originally one of Dr. Owen's assistants. She may have helped turn that crank that I showed you. And in studying the material on it, she came across Bacon's own words in connection with ciphers. They made a great impression upon her. In his De Augmenti Scientiarum, Bacon writes briefly about ciphers in general and says that the virtues required in them are three: that they be easy and not laborious to write, that they be safe and impossible to be deciphered without the key, and lastly, that they be, if possible, such as not to raise suspicion or to elude inquiry. He then goes on to say, but for avoiding suspicion altogether, I will add another contrivance which I devised myself when I was at Paris in my early youth, and which I still think worthy of preservation. That was 40 years later. Let's consult Bacon for further details. Here's a slide showing a couple of pages of the Gilbert Watts 1640 translation of the De Augmentis, the title of the Advancement of Learning. Bacon shows what he calls an example of a biliterary alphabet. That is, one composed of two elements, which taken in groupings of fives yields 32 permutations. In this respect, Bacon anticipated the digital computer boys by several hundred years. This is a binary code. You can use these permutations to represent the letters of the alphabet, says Bacon, but you need only 24 of them, because I and J, U and V were then used interchangeably. These permutations of two things, they may be A's and B's, or apples and oranges, anything you please, can be used to express or to signify messages. Bacon gives a brief example in the word fugue. I got twisted up that somehow. Well, he does give an example. I think it was on that first slide I showed, just the one before this. However, this here, you see, fugue. The F is A-A-B-A-B, the U is B-A-A-B-B, and so forth. Now, here's another example, which quite obviously isn't what it appears to be. A crude picture of a castle. Stones of this castle are shaded and unshaded. And if you start in up here, the A's and B's, it reads. This was prepared by a physician friend of Mrs. Gallup's. My business is to write prescriptions and then to see my doses taken. But now I find I spend my time endeavoring to out-bacon Bacon. Here's another example. This happens to be a class of officers sent to Riverbank Laboratories, where Mrs. Friedman and I were engaged in working on cryptography, and they were sent for instruction in World War I. And this
The photograph contains a cipher message. You will see some of the officers are looking straight forward, some are looking to one side or the other a bit. This chap took me a bit too literally. He happens to be smack in the center of the thing and calls attention to something wrong about that. Otherwise, I don't think anybody would notice. But if you assign these chaps A, B, A, B, that stands for the letter K. A, B, B, A, that's the letter N, and so on. Knowledge is power.
So far, all this is simple enough. Too much so, Bacon says, for the example he used in the case of the word fugue is patently cryptic and would not avoid suspicion under examination. So Bacon goes on to describe the next step, which is to have at hand a biformed alphabet, that is, one in which all the letters of the alphabet, both capital and small, are represented by two slightly different characters. Here is the slide.
Here is the alphabet, the biformed alphabet. Two capital A's, two small A's. Two capital B's, two small B's. In the case of the capital letters, the differentiation is quite marked. In the case of the small letters, lowercase, it's a bit difficult.
Now, Bacon gives an example of using this biformed alphabet for his cipher purposes. There is the fugue with the biliteral equivalents. And here, the equivalents are represented now by the biformed alphabet characters.
And in Latin, while this says scram, or beat it, this says stick around until I get there.
So far, having these at hand, and now when you want to encipher your secret message, you write another external and innocuous message five times as long. You see, this is five times as long as the fugue.
And Bacon gives a longer example. This one is known as the Spartan Dispatch. The external message is very innocuous. In all duty and piety, I satisfy everybody except myself. Myself, I never satisfy. But the secret message is here. All is lost. Mindarus is killed. The soldiers want food. We can neither get hence nor stay longer here.
That's a hell of a position to be in. Now, here's a modern example. I beg pardon of the ladies. I kind of lose my tongue at times. I'll try to restrain myself.
This is a modern example. Here are a biformed alphabet with Roman and italic type, see? And here's an example of a message, a little squeegeed. I'll have to get that remounted. But you can easily tell that there's something wrong with this because of the intermixture of the Roman and the italic letters. This would never get by, but look at this. This message contains that secret message that I showed you. All is lost, Mindarus is killed, and so forth. It would pass inspection, I think, unless you were very, very sharp-eyed. Here, for example, this example was put up in two very slightly different forms of type called Garamond and Imprint.
Now, Bacon's biliteral cipher is an extremely ingenious contrivance. There can be no question whatsoever about its authenticity and utility as a valid cipher. Thousands of people have checked the long example that Bacon gives, and they all find the same answer, the one that Bacon gives. To Mrs. Gallup, this cipher, and especially Bacon's introductory remarks concerning it, quote, came with the same effect as does a bright light to one who has lost his way in the dark night. She soon saw its possibilities, especially when she noticed the wide use of italics in the Shakespeare First Folio. In many cases, particularly in those of capital letters, two different forms are easily noted. Look at this. This is the names of the principal actors, one of the introductory pages to the First Folio. You will see capital letters like this I. There's an I. If you don't believe that's an I, there's another one down here somewhere. Here it is. I and J were the same letter. Same thing is true of the C's. You see this? This page wasn't the first one Mrs. Gallup attacked. She began with a prologue to Troilus and Cressida, which is practically all in italics. She spent long time in laborious experimentation, minute comparison of letters, microscopical examination of their differences, recording them, and so on. She found that the differences between the letters were so slight as to make the task of classifying and assigning them to their respective A and B forms one of enormous difficulty. She never said it was easy. One of her defenders, Dr. Powell, 1916, wrote, quote, "It is not exaggerating to assert that many days of labor were required to formulate the alphabets of the A and B form of each letter employed in the prologue page. Frequently, a letter would be assigned during the examination to the A or to the B form, only to find that such assignment resulted in a combination which was meaningless. Further examination and comparison were then, of course, necessitated, and a redefinition of characteristics of the respective forms followed. One by one, the difficulties, sometimes apparently almost insurmountable, were overcome. Order came out of chaos, principles of form discoverable in each letter were found, and the long hoped for, laboriously sought for treasure finally showed itself to the delighted eyes of that patient prospector. After much labor, Mrs. Gallup felt sure she had succeeded in correctly classifying the letters, for she produced intelligible text using Bacon's own key." Let's see some of the results. From the catalog, the plays, she obtained "Queen Elizabeth is my true mother, and I am the lawful heir to the throne. Find the cipher story my books contain. It tells great secrets, every one of which, if imparted openly, would forfeit my life. Signed, F. Bacon." Now, these are startling statements. But the mere fact that they contravene historical lore, as I have said, shouldn't bother the cryptanalyst, who finds them repeated over and over in Mrs. Gallup's rather large corpus of decipherments. Not only that, but we are confronted with the same sort of statements that Owen's decipherments contain, namely, that Bacon wrote, besides his own extensive works, all those attributed to Shakespeare, Marlowe, Peele, Spencer, Burton, et al. Later on, I hope to be able to throw a little light on this phase of the matter to show how and why such extensive claims are forced upon these decipherers. They can't avoid it. Now let's apply our measuring standards to test the validity of Mrs. Gallup's decipherments. First, as to the technical or semantic validity of the alleged plain texts, it is obvious that the cipher, that the cryptanalyst's requirements are satisfied. The texts are generally in good English. Of course, sometimes the orthography is a bit questionable, and if the texts contain here and there a word which was not known or used in a different sense in Elizabethan times, the cryptanalyst might feel a little uncomfortable. I can cite one case that occurs to me as rather apropos. The word curricula. She deciphered a message which Bacon says, in which Bacon says, according to her, it would be a fine thing to introduce cryptography into the curricula of the universities. Now, in those days, the word curriculum and curricula could have no meaning other than the track upon which horse racing is conducted. And I would be dubious about Mrs. Gallup wishing to introduce horse racing into the universities. Or if the texts contain references to events which did not happen until after the death of the alleged author, it's not the cryptanalyst's business to raise his eyebrows. That's the historian's business. Now, what about the validity of the key or keys in Mrs. Gallup's solutions? Why, the key is identical with that given by Bacon, isn't it? And didn't we agree that Bacon's biliteral cipher was perfectly straightforward, precise, and clear? Didn't we note an incontestable example of its use? Yes, oh yes. Oh, that's true, but we've forgotten one little thing. Do you remember that I emphasized one desideratum in respect to a cryptographic key, namely, that the key, or if more than one, the keys, must be susceptible of being applied with precision? It is hardly necessary to add that if any element of the key or its application is subject to ambiguity, or if it is of such a nature as to require decisions dependent upon factors too tenuous to measure with certainty, it will be difficult, perhaps impossible, for the decipherer to obtain an incontestable answer. Well, therein lies the kernel of the matter in Mrs. Gallup's case. In books of the Elizabethan period, the differences which she claimed to see between the two forms of letters in the great majority of cases were, if not indeed purely subjective, so minute, so tenuous, so imponderable, that the classification of these letters and their assignments into the A and the B forms becomes a matter not of precision in measurement, but one involving the exercise of judgment. Or, as one non-believer alleges Mrs. Gallup herself to have admitted, one involving the exercise of intuitive powers. A little while ago, I said I tried to explain how it comes about that Owen, Gallup, and others find themselves forced to attribute all or a great portion of Elizabethan literature to Baconian authorship. Here it is. One of the significant indications of the non-validity of the cryptographic solutions offered by these anti-Stratfordian cryptographers is the fact that the application of their methods to almost any book will produce, quote, decipherments, unquote. It can hardly fail to do so because their methods are not cryptographically sound. Now, according to their philosophy, Bacon is the great mind that conceived and wrote the plays. Those plays contain cipher messages which were inserted therein by Bacon to establish his authorship. Other books also contain this very same cipher and messages of import similar to those in the folio. Therefore, Bacon must have written these books also. If such a cryptographer lived long enough and worked hard enough, I have no doubt that it would be possible for him to prove Baconian authorship of everything that has ever been written, unless he sooner or later came to realize that there must be something wrong with the basis of all his work, the cipher system itself. Somehow, at this point, I think of the mathematical concepts 1 divided by 1, 1 divided by 0, 0 divided by 1, and 0 divided by 0. If you've got a valid text, cryptographic text, and you apply a valid cipher system to it, you'll get an answer. 1 over 1 is 1. If you've got a valid text and apply an invalid cipher system to it, 1 over 0, the answer to that is infinity. You get an infinite number of answers. If you've got no cryptographic text and apply to it a valid cryptographic system, 0 divided by 1, you get 0. And if you have no valid cipher text and you apply no valid cipher system to it, 0 divided by 0, the answer is indeterminate. You can get as many answers as you please. That's what happens here. Many earnest investigators, including scholars of Elizabethan literature, have spent hundreds of tedious hours in attempting to corroborate Mrs. Gallup's decipherments. Not a single one has been able to verify her work. I assure you that when Mrs. Friedman and I were her colleagues, we tried our very best to do so, and we failed. Verification was impossible without self-deception. This we were not willing to do. In any attempt to explain this impossibility in the case of Mrs. Gallup's work, it is necessary to devote some attention to questions of bibliographical nature, such as the state of the printer's art during Elizabethan and Jacobean times, the matter of how books were printed, proofread, and corrected, and the problems of type founding and the reproduction of type. In chapters 15 to 18 of our book, we discuss Elizabethan printing, and we make it clear that the methods and procedures then in use make it highly improbable, if not impossible, that the biliteral cipher was used to hide secret messages in the Shakespeare plays or in other books of that period. Note that in the preceding sentence, I did not use the phrase "the first folio." There is no such book as the first folio. The advancement of learning. There are no such books. Books then were corrected, and copies were being printed while the corrections were being made. Printing was a closed corporation in those days. There were very few printing machines and presses. They were precious. Paper was hard to get and expensive. You set up type best you knew how. You ran some pages off. You turn them over to proofreaders, but you kept your press going. Proofreaders corrected the pages, sent them back to the press room. The corrections were made as quickly as possible. More proof was run up. More pages. And these pages were used in the final copies. They were not tossed away. Paper was too precious. Printer's type in that era was multiformed rather than biformed, so that there were families of type fonts, not just two, which could be validly called as Mrs. Gallup called them without warrant, the A and the B fonts. In the chapters of our book in which we describe the bibliographical discoveries in recent decades, we tell of an analysis of type fonts in Bacon's Novum Organum by the late world-famed typographer Frederick Gowdy. A study made of the same fonts by Dr. Fred Miller, chief document examiner of the FBI. Studies of typesetting and printing methods by Dr. E.E. Willoughby, the well-known bibliographer at the Folger Shakespeare Library. And the very recent and extremely important studies in the collation of 80 copies of the first folio by Dr. Charlton Hinman of Johns Hopkins University, who says that his studies demonstrate clearly, first, that no two copies of the first folio selected at random should ever be supposed textually identical throughout. And second, that no single copy is likely to preserve anything that can be properly considered the first folio text. Technical data of the foregoing sort simply did not exist in Mrs. Gallup's day. She did not suspect that her decipherment of a single copy of any one book was open to challenge on bibliographical grounds alone. For instance, she got decipherments from the italic letters in the headings of the comedies, histories, and tragedies in the first folio. She wasn't aware, apparently, that the great majority of such headings were printed from type left standing, from form to form. You see, they put up these printed pieces of type, arrange them, and perhaps there would be four forms. And the headings would be left when they changed the content of the forms. Yet, in some cases where it is clear that the printed letters were printed from the identical pieces of type, she assigned the same letters, sometimes to the A form, sometimes to the B form. Finally, I quote from a statement by Professor Hinman, which appears on page 227 of our book. In any given copy of the first folio, there is no full page of the text which is without letters that are so different in appearance from the corresponding letters in other copies that they seem to have been, although they were not, printed from different types. Inking variations are doubtless the commonest cause of these differences, but many other agencies could have, and in various instances unquestionably did, contribute to the result. How shall we explain Mrs. Gallup and her decipherments, which are unacceptable to the professional cryptologists who look at them with unbiased eyes and mind? I've told you enough about our association with her to make it wholly unnecessary to indicate that there never has been in our minds the slightest suspicion that she was a conscious fraud. Was she then an unfortunate victim of self-delusion? I fear that that is what we shall have to say of her, as well as of certain others who have worked in this field. Among the lesser lights in the galaxy of cryptographic stars who have attempted to prove Baconian authorship of the Shakespeare plays, I must not fail to mention several who pin their faith on acrostic, telestic, acrotelestic, and anagrammatic methods, or combinations of such methods, to prove that some writer other than Shakespeare, most of the time, practically all of the time, it's Bacon, wrote the plays. Now, before proceeding with these attempts, I want to make our position perfectly clear. Let me begin by saying that not for one moment do we deny that acrostics and similar methods have been used in certain books or writings. Their employment as contrivances to hide secrets goes back as far as the invention of writing itself. We find clear cases of cipher in hieroglyphics of the Egyptian era. Let us consider first of all some examples of acrostics, and I mean well-known authentic cases such as the one published in a book anonymously in Venice, way back in 1499, under the title Hypnerotomachia Polyphili. Here is one of the pages of that book, reproduced here as big capital R here. Every section begins with a beautiful woodcut capital letter. The initial letters of the successive chapters of this book spell out Polion, Frater, Franciscus, Columna paramavit. Apparently the good or the bad monk had to tell somebody, even if only in cipher, that he was quite enamored of a gal named Polly. Now, many of you know that Edgar Allan Poe wrote at least two poems containing acrostics, each to a different girlfriend. One to Sarah Anna Lewis,